Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Fathers are good for kids. This may strike many of us as pretty obvious, but having a dad who is present and involved tends to result in better outcomes for kids in school and in adult life. And as my guest learned, despite the vitriolic rhetoric about deadbeat dads, there are plenty of poor and even troubled fathers who truly want to play a role, but need guidance as to how to make it work in communities where fathering a child does not always equate to parenting a child. Georgia Leap is Senior Policy Advisor on Gangs and Youth Violence for the City and County of Los Angeles, and she's a member of the faculty of UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Her new book is called Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. Georgia, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
One thing I have to tell you that drew me to this book was thinking about the fact that while many communities have worked to provide parenting education and different kinds of support for mothers in poor communities, there is almost an assumption that fathers in those places are a lost cause.
That's absolutely right. In fact, I really believe that there's this idea that if you aren't a Bill Cosby dad, with all the allegations aside, if you're not that kind of Clifford Huxtable dad, you don't even count. And there's been very little attention in this arena of building family strengths.
How do fathers in poor communities tend to become estranged from their children when it happens?
Well, they get a lot of help from the system. Overwhelmingly, these are men that are part of the new Jim Crow. They are a part of the system of prisons and incarceration. In addition, there's some interesting developments that in projects or housing developments, oftentimes the woman is the individual who has her name on the lease or the rental agreement. And because of this, fathers are powerless in terms of housing or in terms of, I don't want to say ownership, but even being the renters. And then there is the horrific unemployment rate. At the time I've been working in Watts, it's bounced around between 50 and 55% of the population. So you have overall a portrait of both economic and social marginalization.
Yeah, lots of people are aware of the disparate rates of the drug incarceration, low-level drug incarceration for people who are from communities of color or poorer communities. It was really stunning to me here because lots of the men that you met had, in fact, had drug arrests and even drug incarcerations. What struck me was the fact that most of them were not like members of these big gang syndicates. It wasn't like a lifestyle they wanted. They would turn to selling drugs when they needed some quick cash and had nobody would hire them to work a regular job.
Well, there's many aspects of this. First of all, the vast majority of the men in the group were gang affiliated in their youth. But in point of fact, most of them had moved on from that and sort of considered themselves gang alumni, for lack of a better way to put it. And drug dealing was the employment status of choice. This is also because in South LA, the industrial base that had existed there for many decades and served as a source of employment had moved out in the 1960s and 1970s, literally leaving these men without outlets for employment. Drug dealing really was kind of the heavy industry of the area. But it was not the cartels. It was not heavy-duty drug distribution, as I have observed in other environments. This was very petty, low-level, kind of Amway drug dealing, for lack of a better way to put it.
All right. Tell us about life specifically in this community that you feature in this book. It's called Jordan Downs, and it's a housing development inside the Watts neighborhood of L.A. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Excuse me. Jordan Downs is one of three housing developments in Watts, Imperial Courts and Nickerson Gardens being the other two, which were synonymous with gang violence, drug dealing, all the kind of urban social problems of the 1980s, 1990s, and into the 21st century. It is also one of the oldest housing projects in Watts, California, and it's slated to be completely torn down and redeveloped. So it's this community that has a tragic past and the hope for a future, and interestingly, a kind of cross-generational vibrancy. There are people that have lived in and around Jordan Downs and in Watts for generations, and they see this as their community, their home, And what I discovered was there was quite a strong network of love and connection, as well of social support within Jordan Downs. It's also a community, interestingly, that's changing demographically. It's long been African American, but in the past decade, there has been increasing tenants who are Latino. So it also represents a kind of ethnic and racial blending that is interesting and challenging and tumultuous to be engaged with.
Watts is a place that you've had an interest in literally since you were a small child.
Yes, it is in my DNA. My family basically emigrated from Greece and settled in South Los Angeles near to Watts. I grew up near to Watts in an area called Westmont until I reached adolescence. And when I was 9 years old, I vividly recall watching the Watts riots on black and white television while I was staying with my aunt and uncle. And my uncle, who was a history teacher in high school, began to sort of teach me the lessons in terms of economic and social marginalization. And he explained to me that the riots were not about violence. They were about despair and racism. And that made an incredible imprint upon me as a child that later translated really into a lifetime commitment for me, beginning when I was doing my master's in social welfare at UCLA and was placed at Martin Luther King Hospital in Watts. So this has been very much part of me all of my life.
All right, I want to talk a little bit about Project Fatherhood. The philosophy behind it is that there's more to be gained by identifying and building on strengths in challenged communities than swooping in to sort of point out and correct weaknesses. Talk about that.
Absolutely right. It was the brainchild of a man who's now deceased, Dr. Herschel Swinger. And he believed that rather than talking about the absentee father and wringing our hands and trying to support the single mother head of a family, that the fathers should be strengthened as a way of reducing risk factors and helping to build children, their identities, their school performance, and their trajectory into life. Now, interestingly, what Dr. Swinger codified at the Children's Institute, which was a nonprofit, is something that the men in the community were organically realizing themselves. And I think it's very important to stress this point. There was a handful of fathers, Johnny Bailey, Andre Christian, I mention many of their names in my book, My Cummings, who met with young fathers and even young men who were gang involved. They would meet with them on a daily basis. They'd pool their money. They'd buy barbecue. They'd cut hair. And they'd try to sort of mentor these younger men. So that while Dr. Swinger had this brainchild sort of at the nonprofit level, these men in the community were hungry for this experience and were actually organizing on their own. And they have to be lauded for seeing this, just as Dr. Swinger has to be lauded for recognizing this and saying there is a pathway to strengthening our families that is important to recognize and act upon.
Mike Cummings, henceforth to be known in this conversation as he is in the book as Big Mike, is the man who recruited you to work with this program. His story is really fascinating. He's a fascinating individual. Tell us a little bit about his background and how he got involved in this work.
Big Mike is extraordinary. He is one of those larger-than-life characters in many ways, including physically. And he grew up as a young boy in Watts who was hit on by gang members and felt he had no alternative than to join a gang. Later, he was a high school football star, went to junior college, community college, hoped to make it to a four-year university, but got caught up with drug dealing. And Big Mike excels, and he excelled as a drug dealer. He became an associate of Freeway Ricky Ross, and eventually this pathway led him to prison, where he had an epiphany and made a promise to work in his community. And he came out of prison and back into Watts, reborn. And he is a community activist, a peacemaker, and to keep mind, body, and the lives of his wife, Sana, and his daughter, Amani, to keep them all in good company. He works as the operator of a tow truck. So he's a combination tow truck driver, community activist, and Big Mike is just one of those people who has been, as I like to say, my brother, my companion, my bodyguard, my conscience, and he is devoted to changing the Watts community.
The other thing that's fascinating about his story is, if I have this right, he had older children that he had not been in great contact with. It's almost like he was ready to sort of start his life over with his partner now and his daughter now.
Yes, and this is a story that I found parallels to in many cases. There were older children in whose lives he had never participated, and he was a young father when he had them. He had a distant relationship with his own father, and he had no real guide in terms of how to father. When he had this beautiful young daughter, Amani, he made a promise that this time his experience was going to be different. But for Big Mike, as for so many of the men that we love and that we work together with, there was no clear-cut guide. There was no one before them to serve as a role model. And his own story was reflected in the lives of the other men. This is what was particularly poignant.
You had a lot of experience documenting the lives of gang members throughout your career. But with Project Fatherhood, your work really took a different, you went into different territory. Talk about your role with the organization and why you were quick to say yes, even before you quite knew what you were getting yourself into.
I truly did not know what I was getting myself into, and I really thought I had complete control, and I discovered I had none. In the past, I had always been clearly identified as an anthropologist and as a researcher, and that I was someone that was there observing, interviewing, conducting research. This was at Homeboy Industries, where we've engaged in a long-term study, and that was wonderful, but I was the research lady. In Project Fatherhood, I was recruited by Big Mike because CII and Dr. Swinger required that an MSW be part of the group to help with issues with children, to help with issues with the Department of Children and Family Services, custody, potential child neglect, all of the above. I was part of a sort of a rubber stamp in a strange way, in a very positive way. But I was not a researcher. I was part of the mix, and I was co-facilitating the group. The boundaries were very blurred. This is not a research account. This is an ethnography that's a very, very personal account. And as I immersed myself in the group, there were hilarious moments, there were heartbreaking moments, and then there were things that were quite shocking along the way and really shook me to my core.
There was a night when a member of the group essentially stood up and said, listen, let's not lie. Everyone here has beaten his partner at some point, if not multiple times. It's just the way things are in our community.
Yes, that was one of those moments of which there were several. The honesty of that moment, the truthfulness of that moment was quite extraordinary. Nobody in that group said, no, we never did. This man, Terrence, I will never forget it, called everybody to account. It was neither a proud moment nor a moment of despair. It was a moment of complete and total honesty. And literally every man in the room agreed, nodded their heads, and then began to talk about their experiences. It was also a watershed moment for me because they were extremely candid. It was something that they neither approved nor disapproved of, but explained as a matter of course. However, the other point that later occurred was when I told the men that I had been the victim of partner violence. And later on, perhaps I could talk a little bit about what occurred.
We will talk about that in just a minute. My guest is Georgia Leap. She is Senior Policy Advisor on Gangs and Youth Violence for the City and County of Los Angeles and author of the new book Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Georgia Leap, who is on the faculty of UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs and has written a new book called Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Georgia, before the break, we were talking about the fact that in one of the sessions, a number of all of the fathers present said, yes, they had engaged in violence against their partners. And then you mentioned that you shared with them that you had experienced this in your own life. What happened?
It was, I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. They immediately started to ask me who it was, what his name was, and they wanted to know where he lived. And it was this moment of feeling a great sense of protectiveness, but it was also a jumping off point in terms of a dialogue about just what this kind of domestic violence meant and what was the experience of it. And later on in the life of the group, when the entire controversy with Ray Rice erupted, the men hearkened back to this conversation about domestic violence and said, first of all, that they had changed. They didn't see that it had a place in their lives anymore. And second of all, that it was an important lesson for them to share with both their sons and their daughters. Their worries that their sons would perpetrate domestic violence. They were also worried, interestingly enough, that their daughters would both be victims and perpetrators of domestic violence, because they shared that oftentimes women tried to beat on them, as they would say, as well. So it was a very nuanced and interesting conversation. And over the years, the men's viewpoints began to change and soften.
There was also the issue of the proper way to discipline a child, and and there was this question of the difference between, I mean, you can laugh about it now, but the difference between disciplining a child and beating a child, and it was harder for you to see the line of distinction, but in their minds, there was definitely a line that might or might not be crossed, but they felt like they understood where the line was.
Oh, they felt they did, and I'm laughing so I don't scream. Mm-hmm. And this was really an enormous point of contention, because there was a lot of talk about giving and getting whoopings. And at one point, everybody said, we all got whooped, and look how it turned out. And then I sort of, there was a moment of silence. But this was something that we really had very candid, and I would want to tear my hair out, but of course, that's because I was operating from my own value structure as an MSW and as a mandated reporter and somebody who was on guard for neglect and abuse. And after all, this was Herschel Swinger's, you know, brainstorm to prevent child abuse. So I had a lot of agendas that I didn't set them aside, but on a parallel path, I had to listen to what these men had to say. And whooping had been part of their upbringing. But then, and this, the book goes into detail about this, but I will say we had this painful conversation where the men began to describe to me when whooping went too far. And where it involved, one man observed a child that ultimately some very, very deleterious consequences occurred as a result of him, one of his cousins, being whooped. And so there was an open dialogue about when does it go too far. The men were also clear that you couldn't whoop your child because you were just in a bad mood. You had to be disciplining them for some action or some behavior that wasn't proper. So they understood the difference between anger versus discipline. And it was something we were able to sort of drill down to and examine. I can't tell you that we all joined hands and sang Kumbaya, although we all used to join hands and we still join hands at pray at the end of every meeting. I can't say that we came to this perfect agreement, But I certainly gained a deeper understanding for what they had been raised with, what they encountered, what they believed in, and where that line was between discipline and abuse. And I would say it's still sort of a work in progress, even after nearly 5 years. But they are so open about it, even if I was screaming at them, literally, that this was not legal. They would explain to me, while it may not have been legal, it was in fact what they morally understood as the way to raise a child. Strange as that sounds.
What did you do? I'm curious about like your drives home from these Wednesday night meetings after a session like this, where there had been a lot on the table, and you, on the one hand, you're sort of rejoicing that you've had this honest and open conversation that might open the door to changing things. You have this background in social work and in anthropology. You want, on the one hand, to fully understand where they're coming from. You want to put it in cultural context. On the other hand, knowing that children are being hurt, you know, the research now shows even, you know, minor forms of violence against children, and minor is used carefully there, can be damaging. How did you process all this as you would leave these meetings?
I didn't do well. Hmm. I didn't do well. There were meetings where I did walk out and think, this was just the meaning of my life, and I would never have any experience like this, and I loved all the men so much. And then there were meetings where I walked out, like after the fights about child abuse and discipline, where I literally don't even know how I got from Jordan Downs back home, that I was just seething and crying. And it would often take me a couple of days to almost come down from the experience. And I had to really check myself, because there I was, just as you said, with my experience, with my very nice white privilege and my middle class values. And I had to say, wait just a minute, stop taking this personally, listen to what these men are saying to you, and more significantly, listen to what their experience was. And I will tell you, I did not do well. And that is not a commentary on the men. That is a commentary on me. And this is a major story about the men, but it's also a minor story about white privilege and how I had to check myself throughout this process and kind of be very, very careful about the imposition of my own values versus really trying to lift up these men, what they were doing with their children, and the issue of what would be best for their children and for their families. And I can genuinely say, around this issue of child abuse and discipline, this was probably one of the great transformations with these men. They jokingly will tell me how it is different, but I know that that joking betrays the meaning of how they have changed the way that they deal with their children. Later in the book, there are several stories about men bringing their children into the group. And one man openly says, I wanted to beat him. He's talking about his son. But I brought him into the group instead because I don't know what to do. Hmm. And that made all the difference. But I tell you, truly, this was an extremely difficult process to go through for me, for all of us.
You also couldn't help considering the relationship you had with your own father, who was present in your life, sometimes distant. You didn't have an easy, particularly affectionate relationship, but you did have other people that filled that role for you. I mean, you can't look at other people's fatherhood and parenting without looking back on your own experience. It's impossible.
It is utterly impossible. And my father, I do say very emphatically in the book, I was not a daddy's girl. I think in many ways I was sort of this idiosyncratic little creature who my strong Greek father often had difficulty understanding. But what I learned through these men, or what I relearned, was how profound my father's love. He's deceased. He died when I was in my 20s. But I learned about the sort of profound love he carried as a father, even for this daughter that he might not completely understand, but who he completely loved and supported. And as I said, this experience was completely different from being a researcher. And one of the reasons why was it cast that very big light on the relationship with my own father. I don't want to say I rediscovered our love for one another, but what I would say is I discovered a new dimension of the father-daughter relationship that I had not been aware of in my life.
Almost to a one, these men who were trying to find a way to be good parents, they may have had issues with their fathers. They may not have known their fathers. They had an almost a veneration for their mothers, even in cases where mom had been, according to many people's standards, abusive or neglectful. And it seems that pros and cons come with that. And some of the cons are that this really colored the way they thought the responsibility of parenting should shake out.
Yes, it was. First of all, like all of us, the men offered contradictory messages. They wanted to be good fathers in their children's lives. They had very few role models. And then, just using your words, they venerated their mothers and their grandmothers, by the way. And they talked continually about a figure they referred to as Big Mama. And Big Mama was the matriarch, the mother or the grandmother who took care of the family. And they lamented the vanishing of the Big Mamas. And where this kind of idealization of the mother and grandmother made real problems for them was in their expectations of their significant others, their spouses, their partners, their wives, their girlfriends, the mothers of their children. They were constantly measuring these women up against this idealized image. And it made for a lot of conflict, a lot of dashed expectations, and a lot of tumult in relationships. I think there was a need to inject realism into the situation without taking the love away. And that was a difficult balance for all of us to walk.
I want to talk about that phrase, significant others, because you have this group of men who, you know, many of them are unemployed. They just want a job. They've bounced around from back and forth from jail. But they had this really, like, sort of postmodern discussion about how to refer to the mothers of their children.
I loved it. And, okay, this is the part of me that's an anthropologist. So sorry to do this. You know, language is reality.
Yeah.
And one of the big discussions was, we don't want to call them baby mamas. There's a kind of a derogatory cast to that, and it kind of sets up objectification. And they just said, it's not respectful to call them baby mamas. And instead, they really wanted to talk about their significant others. And the significant others, this was sort of the term, sort of the state-of-the-art term they decided upon. And then for many of them, the greatest term of respect was my wife, because when they entered into a legal marriage, they were making a commitment that many of them had not encountered in their own lives growing up as children. So they really wanted to get away from the use of the term baby mama. We also had a big struggle about using the N-word. But baby mama was seen as derogatory, and they really did talk about their significant others. And sometimes they would say it almost in a quasi-sarcastic way, like they wanted to be formal. They were being disrespectful and formal at the same time. Mm-hmm. But they were very much intent on the use of the right terms and showing respect in the end and understanding the role of women they might not always get along with, but with whom they needed to engage to raise their children.
Tell us a little bit about the way they conceived their relationships with their sons versus their daughters. How much of a difference was there depending on the sex of their kids?
As in any family dynamic, going all the way back to Freud, all the way back to the Bible, it was radically different whether it was a girl or a boy. With boys, and probably one of my most eye-opening discussions was when we took up sex, which I approached with trepidation, but which they turned out to be very, very open about. And with boys, they were showing them the ropes. They wanted to teach them how to behave. They also wanted to keep their young boys, their men, their sons out of prison, out of gangs, out of the criminal justice system. And there was an urgency to that concern. With their daughters, they were intent, it was quite unusual, they were intent on teaching their daughters self-respect. They felt this was critical. They really wanted to build on female identity. They didn't want their daughters to take any kind of disrespect for young men. They wanted their daughters to be sure of themselves, to be confident of themselves, to be respectful of themselves. And they were all painfully aware that how they related to their daughters would set the tone for how their daughters related to men throughout their lives. So there was a real differentiation between kind of the mentor and the role model to their sons and making sure that their daughters learned self-respect and how to learn to relate to men. That was what they were intent on with their daughters. And it was quite split between the two. We had two completely different discussions when we were talking about sons as opposed or in contrast to when we were talking about daughters.
Georgia, you give us an incredibly complex picture here of how these men thought about relationships within the family and the importance of a genetic connection or not. On the one hand, you had a number of men who were not altogether positive that children that they chose to be a father to were theirs biologically.
Yes.
On the other hand, you had a lot of men who were raised by stepfathers or quasi-stepfathers who seemed to care about them, and all they could think about was, if only he had been my biological father.
The lines were so blurry, and both of the examples you were using are very telling in terms of the bond these men feel. And I'm sure we'll go on to talk about this. They even felt a bond for youth in the community that were not their own, but that were sort of the wayward youth of Watts. These men felt a very real tie to children that were part of their lives when they were with their significant others, whether or not it had been biologically proven that this was their child. As I said, there are no DNA tests in Watts. Nobody can afford them. Nobody has questions about them. And nobody really inquires too deeply into actual biological parentage. On the other hand, their longing to know the man who was their father, their longing to know who was that person they shared a biological family heritage with, it was palpable and it was painful to listen to. And as I heard certain men say, I never met my father, or I only met my father when he was a little boy. I wished he were still here. They longed for that man from whom they could learn who they were physically as well as psychologically and socially.
We're speaking this hour with Georgia Leap. Her new book is called Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the Senior Policy Advisor on Gangs and Youth Violence for the City and County of Los Angeles, Georgia Leap. She has a new book out called Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Georgia, this is interesting. The program ultimately attracted fathers over a huge age range. You had teenagers, including teenage expectant fathers, and then you had men who were in their 50s and even 60s. How did that age span affect the group dynamic and ultimately the goals the group set for itself?
It was fantastic. And this was once again where I was proven wrong because I was truly worried about the age range and could they relate. But what happened was the older fathers, the more experienced fathers, the fathers who had had three or four or in one case eight children, they became sort of the father mentors to the young, teenaged, expectant fathers. And this incredible dynamic of parentage evolved literally inside the group. And I hope you won't mind if I take a moment to say all the proceeds of this book are going to go directly to these men and to Project Fatherhood in Jordan Downs. So what I learned from them really is incalculable. What I did see happen with these young men was they were drawn to these older fathers. They had the older fathers had credibility. They had been through everything. They had seen through everything. They knew what the pressures were in Watts. They knew the economic pressures. They knew violence. And they had true credibility in the eyes of these younger men. That doesn't mean they didn't fight, because they fought between the generations and they fought with me. But fighting is really the wrong word. There was an incredible sharing and intimacy that came through this arguing about just what was the right way to raise a child, and just what would they experience out there in the world, and what did these expectant fathers have to begin to face as they were raising their soon-to-be-born sons and daughters.
Did they talk a lot about family planning?
Yes, and mainly when I tried to raise the specter of, I will never forget the condom discussion as long as I live, because they all started laughing at me, because it just was not something that was part of their values or their repertoire. And even when I talked to them about it in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, it was not a topic for discussion that fell upon a very receptive audience. Let me say it the most politically correct way. And it was truly their belief that you have children and children are your wealth. They are why you are put on this earth. This is what you do. You have them and you raise them and you try to sort of leave a heritage behind. And as I looked at the deeper meaning, I don't think their feelings were any different than the feelings I had in raising my own child, my daughter. This was kind of their children are their hostage to fortune. And they didn't want to hear about birth control. They didn't want to hear about contraception. And interestingly, when these teenagers became expectant fathers, it was not viewed as the end of the world, because I started running around saying, what about school? What about college? And they looked at me like, they'll go to college. In other words, having a baby, even as at a young age, was not seen as an obstacle. It was seen as what you do in life.
Were you able to convey to them that it may not be seen as an obstacle, but statistically it is likely to get in the way of those goals?
They didn't care. They didn't care. They have such a strong belief in the life force. And this was where I learned so much. They didn't see the baby or babies or children as the obstacle. They saw the criminal justice system as the obstacle. They saw the lack of employment as the obstacle. They saw underperforming schools as the obstacles. Babies were minor. What was going wrong in the different systems in which they engaged were the major obstacles. And, you know, the light bulb went on in my head many times that, yes, in fact, what they were saying was absolutely the truth.
So gangs are a huge part of life in this community for a variety of reasons. One thing that I found really surprising was that in the case of, you would assume that they just want to sort of get everybody in. In the case of one young man that was sort of universally recognized to be really good at school and devoted to school, the gangs left him alone.
Yes, our beloved Matt. Matt was somebody that was a couple of the gang members in the community, not in the group, but in the community, they would refer to him as college boy, because this young man was exceptional and is exceptional. And gangs have a real respect for intelligence, and at times they will try to recruit intelligence into their membership. And at times they will also recognize there are people to be left alone. And this was part of the interesting calculus I saw in gangs. And I saw this in gangs in South Los Angeles. I also saw this in gangs that I learned about as I have worked at Homeboy Industries with Father Greg Boyle. There is a calculus: who belongs, who should be left alone, who should be discouraged from membership, all of the above.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Susan on the line in Arlington. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I was a teacher for 10 years in a very economically disadvantaged school, and the culture sounds exactly like what you described from Watts. and the intergenerational poverty, no male role models, the big mama, and the discipline, the whoopings with extension cords and that kind of thing. But I was wondering, do you see any chance of bringing marriage back to stabilize these families, like for these young people to wait till they go to college to have children or to get married if they are going to have children? It just seems like the lack of fathers stems from that, from the lack of marriage and commitment between the mothers and the fathers.
What can you say about that, Georgia?
It's very complicated. It's and I really appreciate what you're saying. I can tell you that marriage is not an either-or proposition. And the older fathers in the group were all married. But there was a kind of ambivalence about making that commitment, to whom that commitment would be made. But I can tell you there is a very, very – there is a great acceptance and a very, very positive valuing of marriage. But this also comes under that heading of they have very few role models. I could not sit around with this group and say, where have you seen a strong marriage in your life? Now, on the other hand, when we began to talk about marriage, they began to make fun of white people. And they talked about how many marriages white people had. And, you know, I had to shut my big mouth because I've had two marriages. My husband's had four marriages. So there's part of the stabilizing aspect of marriage. And the other part of it is this is only one of the factors that they consider. They consider – and the other thing is they want to be ready to be married. They want to be working. They want to be a provider. They don't want to get married just for the sake of being married. So I can tell you quite genuinely, they are not anti-marriage, but it's part of interrelated factors that they all aspire to. For example, they all admired Big Mike because he had a very strong marriage with his wife and was intent on raising his daughter. And they wanted that in their own lives, in their own marriages. And I can honestly say they are there. They want to be married or they are married, but they want stability in employment. They want stability in housing and with their children.
How does the rate of incarceration affect the intentions of fathers like these to be fully involved in their children's lives?
What was striking about these men is they have made a vow never to be incarcerated again, never to engage in activities that will lead them down that pathway. Now, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but that is met with varying results. However, they are acutely aware that this is a danger every day of their lives, and their relationship with law enforcement, which is very, very tumultuous and very difficult, also speaks to that reality. I would tell you they are more well-versed in the prison industrial complex. They are more well-versed in gang sentencing and gang enhancement and mandatory minimums. I had a lot of jailhouse lawyers, for lack of a better way to put it, in our group together. It is the shadow that follows them no matter what they are doing.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have George on the line in Plano. Hello, George.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Hi. I'm a 70-year-old political scientist and a criminologist, and have basically been studying all this kind of thing, this type of society for the past 50 years, going back into the, the struggles that came from the civil rights movements in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very well that, there were a couple of pretty significant riots took place in Watts back then.
Yes.
Which I guess was probably, certainly maybe the grandparents involved, the grandfathers, I should say, of these young men you've been talking about. And I'm just kind of wondering if, if I'm sort of wondering why the city of Los Angeles and the state of California has allowed this kind of thing to just continue on all this time. It hasn't actually gone in there in one way or another, various ways, and taken over that whole area of the city and taken control of it and basically changed it.
Do you think they could do that, Georgia?
Well, I think, in fact, They are doing that. I think, first of all, there is something called the Community Safety Partnership that exists in Watts, and I touch on it in the book. It's not the subject of the book. There was a great article done by John Bunton in the New York Times Magazine about this partnership between former gang members. They are not snitches at all, but they work with the community, with community members, and they work with the LAPD to diminish crime. There are also cameras that have been put up to record what is going on, to record crime. There is the Los Angeles City Gang Reduction Youth Development Program that pumps millions of dollars into what are called gang-impacted zones throughout the city of Los Angeles, including Watts, which includes gang prevention and gang intervention programs. They are redeveloping Jordan Downs so it will not look like a housing project, but it will become a mixed-use community. And there are certain laws that were enacted during the Clinton administration, to go back a ways, that require that once an individual has been convicted of a gang-related crime or violence, they can no longer live in a housing development in Watts. So, and by the way, Martin Luther King Hospital was constructed in the aftermath of the Watts riots. There was Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. There have been many, many efforts. Here's the problem, and you have a great question, and you have studied this longer than I. I mean, half a century is a long time to be a criminologist, and I have great respect for that. Here's the real deal. A lot of the solutions have come from the outside. What I am learning and what I have learned is that the leadership must come from the inside. These men have the credibility to be the leaders. These men have seen the kind of violence that has caused havoc in this community. These men are interested in healing their own community. Somebody like me who comes from the outside can help. The mayor's office can impose a program and help. But the real change and the real leadership has to come from inside. These are the people who live in the community, who understand the community, who are part of this community. And this is who we have to build up. But I think there have been sincere efforts at change. And if I compare Watts of 50 years ago to Watts today, it is a completely different place than it once was.
The one thing everyone seemed to have in common was that what they really, really wanted was a job. They didn't all necessarily want to escape. They didn't all necessarily have the same vision of what a good family life would look like. They all wanted to be working.
Yes. In fact, it was a point of pride when some of these fathers talked about how they raised some of their children on their own, not on the county. They considered it a point of pride that they not raise a child on welfare or on aid to dependent families or anything like that. These men desperately, desperately wanted to work. Even there's a story in the book where someone comes from the mayor's office to talk about a summer program, and the men are interested if they can get jobs even in this summer program. They are hungry to work. I felt it. It was palpable. It was real. They do not want to cash a welfare check. It is undeniable.
Georgia Leap is Senior Policy Advisor on Gangs and Youth Violence for the City and County of Los Angeles, and she's a member of the faculty of UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Her new book is Project Fatherhood, a story of courage and healing in one of America's toughest communities. Georgia, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me this past hour. I'm grateful.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.